Sorry, he says again, reflexively.
Stop apologizing.
She laughs. He introduces himself.
I'm Howard Fallon. I teach history. You're standing in for Finian O'Dolig.
That's right,
she says.
Apparently he's going to be out till Christmas, whatever happened to him.
Gallstones,
Howard says.
Oh.
Howard wishes he could unsay gallstones.
So,
he re-begins effortfully.
I'm actually on my way home. Can I give you a lift?
She cocks her head.
Didn't you have a meeting?
Yes,
he remembers.
But it isn't really that important.
I have my own car. Thanks all the same. But I suppose you could carry my books, if you like.
Okay.
Possibly the offer is ironic, but before she can retract it, he removes the stack of binders and textbooks from her hands, and, ignoring the homicidal looks from a small clump of her pupils still mooning about the corridor, walks alongside her towards the exit.
So, how are you finding it?
He asks, attempting to haul the conversation to a more equilibrious state.
Have you taught much before, or is this your first time?
Oh.
She blows upwards at a wayward strand of golden hair.
I'm not a teacher by profession. I'm just doing this as a favour for Greg, really. Mr. Costigan, I mean. God, I'd forgotten about this Mr. Miss stuff. It's so funny. Miss McIntyre.
Staff are allowed to use first names, you know.
Actually, I'm quite enjoying being Miss McIntyre. Anyhow, Greg and I were talking one day, and he was saying they were having problems finding a good substitute. And it so happens that once upon a time I had fantasies of being a teacher. And I was between contracts, so I thought, why not?
What's your field normally?
He holds open the main door for her, and they step out into the autumn air, which has grown cold and crisp.
Investment banking?
Howard receives this information with a studied neutrality, then says casually,
I used to work in that area myself, actually. Spent about 2 years in the city. Futures, primarily.
What happened?
He cracks a grin.
Don't you read the papers? Not enough future to go around.
She doesn't react, waiting for the correct answer.
Well, I'll probably get back into it someday. This is just a temporary thing, really. I sort of fell into it. Although, at the same time, it's nice, I think, to give something back. To feel like you're making a difference.
They make their way around the sixth year's car park, a series of Lexuses and TTs. And Howard's heart sinks as his own car comes into view.
What's with the feathers?
Oh, it's nothing.
He sweeps his hand along the car's roof, ploughing a mighty drift of white feathers over the side. They pluff to the ground, from where some float back up to adhere to his trousers. Miss McIntyre takes a step backwards.
It's just a sort of a gag the boys play.
They call you Howard the Coward,
she remarks, like a tourist inquiring the meaning of a puzzling local idiom.
Yes.
Howard laughs mirthlessly, shoveling more feathers from his windscreen and bonnet, and not offering an explanation.
You know, they're good kids generally in this place, but there's a few that can be a bit, high-spirited.
I'll be on my guard.
Well, like I say, it's just a small percentage. Most of them... I mean, generally speaking, it's a wonderful place to work.
You're covered in feathers,
she says judiciously.
Yes.
He harumphs, swiping his trousers summarily, straightening his tie. Her eyes, which are a brilliant and dazzling shade of blue, custom-made for sparkling mockingly, sparkle mockingly at him. Howard has had enough humiliation for one day. He is just about to bow out with the last shreds of his dignity when she says,
So what's it like, teaching history?
What's it like?
I'm really liking doing geography again.
She gazes dreamily around at the ice-blue sky, the yellowing trees.
You know, these titanic battles between different forces that actually created the shape of the world we're walking around in today. It's so dramatic.
She squeezes her hands sensually, a goddess forging worlds out of raw matter, then fixes the eyes on Howard again.
And history? That must be so much fun.
That isn't the first word that springs to mind. But Howard limits himself to a bland smile.
What are you teaching at the moment?
Well, in my last class, we were doing the First World War.
Oh!
She claps her hands.
I love the First World War. The boys must be enjoying that.
You'd be surprised.
You should read them Robert Graves.
Who?
He was in the trenches.
She replies, then adds, after a pause,
he was also one of the great love poets.
I'll take a look.
He scowls.
Any other tips for me? Any other lessons you've gleaned from your 5 days in the profession?
She laughs.
If I have any more, I'll be sure and pass them on. It sounds like you need them.
She lifts the books out of Howard's arms and aims her car key at the enormous white-gold SUV parked next door to Howard's dilapidated Bluebird.
See you tomorrow.
Right.
But she doesn't move, and neither does he. She holds him there a moment, purely by the light of her spectacular eyes, looking him over with the tip of her tongue tucked in the corner of her mouth, as if she is deciding what to have for dinner. Then, smiling at him coyly with a row of pointed white teeth, she says,
"You know, I'm not going to sleep with you."
At first, Howard is sure he must have misheard her. And, when he realizes that he is not, he is still too stunned to reply. So he just stands there, or perhaps totters. And the next thing he knows, she's climbed into her jeep and pulled away, sending white feathers swirling about his ankles. The door swings open with a creak, and you step inside, into the great hall. Spiderwebs cover everything, drifting from floor to ceiling like veils from a thousand left-behind brides. You look at the map and go through a door on the far side of the hall. This room used to be the library. Books cover the floor in dusty piles. On the table is a scroll, but before you can read it, the grandfather clock bursts open and there are 1, 2, 3 zombies coming at you. You swipe at them with the torch and duck round the other side of the table. But more appear in the doorway, drawn by the smell of someone alive.
Skippy, this is totally boring.
Yeah, Skip, do you think someone else could ever go, maybe?
I'll just be a second, Skippy mumbles, as the zombies pursue him up a rickety staircase.
What do you think these zombies do all day?
Jeff wonders.
When there's no one around, they want to eat.
They order pizza,
Dennis says.
Which Mario's dad delivers.
I told you 1,000 times, my father is not a pizza delivery man. He is an important diplomat in the Italian embassy.
Mario snaps.
Seriously, though, how often is anyone going to call into their creepy house? Like, what do? Just wander around it all day long, moaning to each other?
They sound sort of like my parents.
Jeff realizes. He gets up and stretches out his arms and staggers around the room, saying in a sepulchral zombie voice,
Jeff, put out the garbage. Jeff, I can't find my glasses. We've made great sacrifices to send you to that school, Jeff.
Skippy wishes they would stop talking. Heat coils round his brain like a fat snake, tighter and tighter, making his eyelids heavy. And now, just for a second, the screen blurs. Enough time for a raggy arm to fling itself around his neck. He shakes awake. He tries to wriggle free. But it's too late. They're all over him, pulling him to the ground, crowding around till he can't even see himself, their long nails slashing down, their rotten teeth gnashing, and a little spinning light that is his soul whirls up to the ceiling.
Game over, Skippy,
Jeff says in the zombie voice, laying a heavy hand on his shoulder.
Finally,
Mario says.
Now can we play something else?
Skippy's dorm, like all the other dorms, is in the tower, which sits at the end of Our Lady's Hall, and is the very oldest part of Seabrook. In days of yore, when the school was first built, the entire student population ate, slept, and sat through classes here. Nowadays, day boys form the majority of the pupils, and out of each year of 200, there are only 20 or 30 unlucky souls who have to come back here after the bell has gone. Any Harry Potter-type fantasies tend to get squashed pretty quickly. Life in the Tower, an ancient building composed mostly of drafts, is a deeply unmagical experience, spent at the mercy of lunatic teachers, bullies, athletes' foot epidemics, etc. There are some small consolations. At a point in life in which the lovely, nurturing homes built for them by their parents have become unendurable Guantanamos, and any time spent away from their peers is experienced at best as a mind-numbing commercial break for things no one wants to buy on some old person's TV channel, and at worst as a torture not incomparable to being actually genuinely nailed to a cross, the boarders do enjoy a certain prestige among the boys. They have a sort of sheen of independence. They can cultivate mysterious personae without having to worry about mums or dads showing up and blowing the whole thing by telling people about amusing accidents they had when they were little, or by publicly admonishing them to please stop walking around with their hands wedged in their pockets like a pervert. Unarguably, the best thing about being a boarder, though, is that the tower overlooks, in spite of the feverish tree-planting efforts of the priests, the yard of St. Bridget's, the girls' school next door. Every morning, lunchtime and evening, the air rings with high feminine voices, like lovely secular bells. And at night-time, before they close the curtains, you can see, without even needing to look through the telescope, which is a good thing, because Ruprecht is extremely particular about what his telescope is used for, and always keeps it pointed into the girl-less reaches of the sky above. Your female counterparts, walking around in the upper windows, talking, brushing their hair, or even, if you believe Mario, doing naked aerobics. That's as close as you'll get, though. Because while it's the constant subject of plans and boasts and tall tales, no one has ever verifiably breached the wall between the two schools. Nor has anyone conceived of a way past the St. Bridget's janitor and his infamous dog, Nipper. Not to mention the terrifying ghost nun, who, legend has it, roams the grounds after dark, wielding either a crucifix or pinking shears, depending on who you talk to. Ruprecht van Doren, owner of the telescope and Skippy's roommate, is not like the other boys. He arrived at Seabrook in January, like a belated and non-returnable Christmas gift, after both his parents were lost on a kayaking expedition up the Amazon. Prior to their deaths, he had been schooled at home by tutors flown in from Oxford, at the behest of his father, Baron Maximilian van Doren. And consequently, he has quite a different attitude to education from his peers. For Ruprecht, the world is a compendium of fascinating facts just waiting to be discovered, and a difficult maths problem is like sinking into a nice, warm bath. A cursory glance around the room will give an idea of his current projects and interests. Maps of many kinds cover the walls. Maps of the moon, of near and far-off constellations, a map of the world stuck with little pins marking recent UFO sightings, as well as a picture of Einstein and score sheets commemorating notable Yahtzee victories. The telescope, bearing a sign that reads in big black letters, "Do not touch," points out the window. A French horn gleams pompously from the foot of the bed. On the desk, hidden beneath a sheaf of inscrutable printouts, his computer performs mysterious operations whose full nature is known only to its owner. Impressive as this may be, it represents only a fraction of Ruprecht's activity, most of which takes place in his lab, one of the dingy antechambers off the basement. Down here, surrounded by yet more computers and parts of computers, more towers of unfathomable papers and electrical arcana, Ruprecht constructs equations, conducts experiments, and continues his pursuit of what he considers the holy grail of science, the secret of the origins of the universe.
Newsflash, Ruprecht. They know about the origins of the universe. It's called the Big Bang. Aha, but what happened before the bang? What happened during it? What was it that banged?